Chapter 30. No. Apostrophe apostrophe, do you put the offender off at the next station? Apostrophe apostrophe, well, no, of course we couldn't, if he had a ticket. Apostrophe apostrophe, do you have him up before a court? Apostrophe apostrophe, the conductor was silent and apparently troubled. The major started a new deal, and said, you see that you are helpless, and that the company has placed you in a foolish position. You are furnished with an arrogant order, and you deliver it in a blustering way, and when you come to look into the matter you find you haven't any way of enforcing obedience. Apostrophe apostrophe, the conductor said, with chill dignity. Gentlemen, you have heard the order, and my duty is ended. As to obeying it or not, you will do as you think fit. Apostrophe apostrophe, and he turned to leave. But wait. The matter is not yet finished. I think you are mistaken about your duty being ended. But if it really is, I myself have a duty to perform yet. Apostrophe apostrophe, how do you mean? Apostrophe apostrophe, are you going to report my disobedience at headquarters in Pittsburgh? Apostrophe apostrophe, no. What good would that do? Apostrophe, you must report me, or I will report you. Apostrophe apostrophe, report me for what? Apostrophe apostrophe, for disobeying the company's orders in not stopping this game. As a citizen, it is my duty to help the railway companies keep their servants to their work. Apostrophe apostrophe, are you in earnest? Apostrophe apostrophe, yes, I am in earnest. I have nothing against you as a man, but I have this against you as an officer, that you have not carried out that order, and if you do not report me, I must report you. And I will. Apostrophe, the conductor looked puzzled, and was thoughtful a moment, then he burst out with, I seem to be getting myself into a scrape. It's all a muddle, I can't make head or tail of it. It never happened before. They always knocked under, and never said a word, and so I never saw how ridiculous that stupid order with no penalty is. I don't want to report anybody, and I don't want to be reported. Why, it might do me no end of harm. No, do go on with the game, play the whole day, if you want to, and don't let's have any more trouble about it. Apostrophe apostrophe, no, I only sat down here to establish this gentleman's rights. He can have his place now. But before, won't you tell me, what do you think the company made this rule for? Can you imagine an excuse for it? I mean a rational one, an excuse that is not on its face silly, and the invention of an idiot. Question mark apostrophe, why, surely I can. The reason it was made is plain enough. It is to save the feelings of the other passengers, the religious ones among them, I mean. They would not like it to have the Sabbath desecrated by card playing on the train. Apostrophe apostrophe, I just thought as much. They are willing to desecrate it themselves by traveling on Sunday, but they are not willing that other people apostrophe, by gracious, you've hit it. I never thought of that before. The fact is, it is a silly rule, when you come to look into it. Apostrophe apostrophe, at this point the train conductor arrived, and was going to shut down the game in a very high-handed fashion, but the parlor car conductor stopped him, and took him aside to explain. Nothing more was heard of the matter. I was ill in bed 11 days in Chicago, and got no glimpse of the fair, for I was obliged to return east as soon as I was able to travel. The major secured and paid for a stateroom in a sleeper the day before we left, so that I could have plenty of room and be comfortable. But when we arrived at the station, a mistake had been made, and our car had not been put on. The conductor had reserved a section for us. It was the best he could do, he said. But Major said we were not in a hurry, and would wait for the car to be put on. The conductor responded, with pleasant irony, it may be that you are not in a hurry, just as you say, but we are. Come, get aboard, gentlemen, get aboard, don't keep us waiting. Apostrophe apostrophe, but the Major would not get aboard himself, nor allow me to do it. He wanted his car, and said he must have it. This made the hurried and perspiring conductor impatient, and he said, "It's the best we can do. We can't do impossibilities. You will take the section or go without. A mistake has been made, and can't be rectified at this late hour. It's a thing that happens now and then, and there is nothing for it but to put up with it and make the best of it. Other people do." Ah, that is just it, you see. If they had stuck to their rights and enforced them, you wouldn't be trying to trample mine underfoot in this bland way now. I haven't any disposition to give you unnecessary trouble, but it is my duty to protect the next man from this kind of imposition. So I must have my car. Otherwise I will wait in Chicago and sue the company for violating its contract. Sue the company? For a thing like that? Certainly. Do you really mean that? Indeed, I do. The conductor looked the major over wonderingly, and then said, "It beats me, it's brand new, I've never struck the mate to it before. But I swear I think you'd do it. Look here, I'll send for the station dash master." When the station master came, he was a good deal annoyed at the major, not at the person who had made the mistake. He was rather brusque, and took the same position which the conductor had taken in the beginning, but he failed to move the soft-spoken artilleryman, who still insisted that he must have his car. However, it was plain that there was only one strong side in this case, and that side was the major's. The station master banished his annoyed manner, and became pleasant, and even half-apologetic. This made a good opening for a compromise, and the major made a concession. He said he would give up the engaged state-room, but he must have a stateroom. After a deal of ransacking, one was found whose owner was persuadable. He exchanged it for our section, and we got away at last. The conductor called on us in the evening, and was kind, and courteous and obliging, and we had a long talk, and got to be good friends. He said he wished the public would make trouble oftener, it would have a good effect. He said that the railroads could not be expected to do their whole duty by the traveler, unless the traveler would take some interest in the matter himself. I hoped that we were done reforming for the trip now, but it was not so. In the hotel car, in the morning, the major called for broiled chicken. The waiter said, "It's not in the bill of fare, sir. We do not serve anything but what is in the bill." That gentleman yonder is eating a broiled chicken. Yes, but that is different. He is one of the superintendents of the road. Then all the more must I have broiled chicken. I do not like these discriminations. Please hurry, bring me a broiled chicken. The waiter brought the steward, who explained in a low and polite voice that the thing was impossible, it was against the rule, and the rule was rigid. Very well, then, you must either apply it impartially, or break it impartially. You must take that gentleman's chicken away from him, or bring me one. The steward was puzzled, and did not quite know what to do. He began an incoherent argument, but the conductor came along just then, and asked what the difficulty was. The steward explained that here was a gentleman who was insisting on having a chicken, when it was dead against the rule, and not in the bill. The conductor said, "Stick by your rules, you haven't any option. Wait a moment, is this the gentleman?" Then he laughed and said, "Never mind your rules, it's my advice, and sound. Give him anything he wants, don't get him started on his rights. Give him whatever he asks for, and if you haven't got it, stop the train and get it." The major ate the chicken, but said he did it from a sense of duty, and to establish a principle, for he did not like chicken. I missed the fare, it is true, but I picked up some diplomatic tricks which I and the reader may find handy and useful as we go along. Diplomatic pay and clothes, Vienna, January 5. I find in this morning's papers the statement that the government of the United States has paid to the two members of the Peace Commission entitled to receive money for their services $100,000 each for their 6 weeks' work in Paris. I hope that this is true. I will allow myself the satisfaction of considering that it is true, and of treating it as a thing finished and settled. It is a precedent, and ought to be a welcome one to our country. A precedent always has a chance to be valuable as well as the other way, and its best chance to be valuable or the other way is when it takes such a striking form as to fix a whole nation's attention upon it. If it come justified out of the discussion which will follow, it will find a career ready and waiting for it. We realize that the edifice of public justice is built of precedents, from the ground upward, but we do not always realize that all the other details of our civilization are likewise built of precedents. The changes also which they undergo are due to the intrusion of new precedents, which hold their ground against opposition and keep their place. A precedent may die at birth, or it may live. It is mainly a matter of luck. If it be imitated once, it has a chance, if twice a better chance, if three times it is reaching a point where account must be taken of it, if four, five, or six times, it has probably come to stay for a whole century, possibly. If a town start a new bow, or a new dance, or a new temperance project, or a new kind of hat, and can get the precedent adopted in the next town, the career of that precedent is begun, and it will be unsafe to bet as to where the end of its journey is going to be. It may not get this start at all, and may have no career. But, if a crown prince introduce the precedent, it will attract vast attention, and its chances for a career are so great as to amount almost to a certainty. For a long time we have been reaping damage from a couple of disastrous precedents. One is the precedent of shabby pay to public servants standing for the power and dignity of the Republic in foreign lands. The other is a precedent condemning them to exhibit themselves officially in clothes which are not only without grace or dignity, but are a pretty loud and pious rebuke to the vain and frivolous costumes worn by the other officials. To our day an American ambassador's official costume remains under the reproach of these defects. At a public function in a European court, all foreign representatives except ours wear clothes which in some way distinguish them from the unofficial throng and mark them as standing for their countries. But our representative appears in a plain black swallowtail, which stands for neither country nor people. It has no nationality. It is found in all countries. It is as international as a nightshirt. It has no particular meaning. But our government tries to give it one. It tries to make it stand for Republican simplicity, modesty and unpretentiousness. Tries, and without doubt fails, for it is not conceivable that this loud ostentation of simplicity deceives anyone. The statue that advertises its modesty with a fig leaf really brings its modesty under suspicion. Worn officially, our non-conforming swallowtail is a declaration of ungracious independence in the matter of manners, and is uncourteous. It says to all around, in Rome we do not choose to do as Rome does, we refuse to respect your tastes and your traditions, we make no sacrifices to anyone's customs and prejudices, we yield no jot to the courtesies of life, we prefer our manners, and intrude them here. That is not the true American spirit, and those clothes misrepresent us. When a foreigner comes among us, and trespasses against our customs and our code of manners, we are offended, and justly so, but our government commands our ambassadors to wear a broad and official dress which is an offense against foreign manners and customers, and the discredit of it falls upon the nation. We did not dress our public functionaries in undistinguished raiment before Franklin's time, and the change would not have come if he had been in obscurity. But he was such a colossal figure in the world, that whatever he did of an unusual nature attracted the world's attention, and became a precedent. In the case of clothes, the next representative after him, and the next, had to imitate it. After that, the thing was custom, and custom is a petrifaction. Nothing but dynamite can dislodge it for a century. We imagine that our queer official costumery was deliberately devised to symbolize our republican simplicity, a quality which we have never possessed, and are too old to acquire now, if we had any use for it or any leaning toward it. But it is not so. There was nothing deliberate about it. It grew naturally and heedlessly out of the precedent set by Franklin. If it had been an intentional thing, and based upon a principle, it would not have stopped where it did. We should have applied it further. Instead of clothing our admirals and generals, for courts-martial and other public functions, in superb dress uniforms blazing with color and gold, the government would put them in swallowtails and white cravats, and make them look like ambassadors and lackeys. If I am wrong in making Franklin the father of our curious official clothes, it is no matter, he will be able to stand it. It is my opinion, and I make no charge for the suggestion, that whenever we appoint an ambassador or a minister, we ought to confer upon him the temporary rank of admiral or general, and allow him to wear the corresponding uniform at public functions in foreign countries. I would recommend this for the reason that it is not consonant with the dignity of the United States of America that a representative should appear upon occasions of state in a dress which makes him glaringly conspicuous. And that is what his present undertaker outfit does when it appears, with its dismal smudge, in the midst of the butterfly splendors of a continental court. It is a most trying position for a shy man, a modest man, a man accustomed to being like other people. He is the most striking figure present. There is no hiding from the multitudinous eyes. It would be funny, if it were not such a cruel spectacle, to see the hunted creature in his solemn sables scuffling around in that sea of vivid color, like a mislaid Presbyterian in perdition. We are all aware that our representative's dress should not compel too much attention, for anybody but an Indian chief knows that that is a vulgarity. I am saying these things in the interest of our national pride and dignity. Our representative is the flag. He is the Republic. He is the United States of America. And when these embodiments pass by, we do not want them scoffed at. We desire that people shall be obliged to concede that they are worthily clothed, and politely. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.